Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, millions of Jewish families around the world are celebrating Passover with storytelling, wine, and food. If you don't know, Passover is a religious festival, commemorates the liberation of the Israelites from slavery in ancient Egypt, and it's filled with powerful symbolism. This cedar meal takes center stage. It has many elements, and each item has its own symbolic meaning. And like the story behind Passover, these foods have been passed down for generations and have a huge significance for lots of people. So we're going to explore this delicious tradition, unpack the symbolism, and look at how people are celebrating today. And here with me to do all this are two absolutely fantastic guests. Nora Rubel is chair of the Department of Religion and Classics at the University of Rochester in the USA. Hello there, Nora.
Hi.
Great to have you. And Helene Sinrich is director of the Fern and Manfred Steinfeld Program in Judaic Studies at the University of Tennessee. Hello there, Helene.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, just before we start, I'd like to say nobody has ever invited me to a Passover feast. And I wondered, is that because it's not something, it's a very personal thing, and you have it with your families, and outsiders like me are not, you know, it's not interesting to drag me in and tell me what it's all about. Is it very much something that is within families, Nora?
Oh, well, I am horrified that you have not been invited by anyone to a Passover meal.
It could be my table manners, of course. You know, so.
I mean, I will say that I believe that for the most part, it originates among families, right? It is a family-centric meal, but frequently people invite friends and outsiders. And I personally think it is great to have someone who's not Jewish at the Seder, because you are telling the same story every year. And you always have someone who might have some interesting questions that haven't come up before. So,
yeah, that's fair enough.
Yes, I mean, certainly, you know, families celebrate together, but it is not unusual to bring in other people.
In fact, in some traditions, they actually require you to invite outsiders to come to the Seder meal. There's actually a part of the structured meal that says, "All who are hungry, please come and join us." And some people have interpreted that to mean that they should invite someone outside the family to join them. My own family has a tradition that when we would open the door for Elijah, which is part of the set meal, and the dog would come in, that we would then feed the dog too, because of this idea that anyone who came in the door was welcome to join us.
Oh, very good. So literally, I am the only person who's not been invited to the Passover meal. Everyone else has. Okay, well, Helene, I'm coming over to yours then. So Nora, let's just start with some basic terminology. Where does the name Passover come from?
Okay, so Passover, sometimes heard, referred to as Pesach. The name comes from what's seen as a miracle in which God passed over the houses of the Israelites during the 10th plague, which is the big plague, the slaughtering of the firstborn. And so, according to tradition, Israelites marked their doorposts with blood, lamb's blood, and the angel of death passed over and did not go after the firstborn of the Israelites. This is how to distinguish it. It's not. It's also known as Chag HaMatzot, which is the holiday of the unleavened bread. So it has several names, but Passover is the one we all kind of know. And it also has similarities to Easter in many other languages, such as Pasqua. Outside of English, Passover and Easter tend to share the same title, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Helene, now food is absolutely central to proceedings here, but it's packed with symbolism. Now, I mean, you know, I see food as being important and having a great amount of depth and history and sex, love, guilt, all these different things. But I would say that the actual symbolism and applying stories to different ingredients is not part of my culture. Why is that? How come Jewish people are so good at wrapping stories around faith?
I mean, certainly Judaism is a tradition that is filled with storytelling, and certainly many of our holiday meals, including Passover, include eating symbolic foods and imbuing them with symbolism. So the Seder, for example, which is a festive holiday meal that actually means order. This is because the meal is eaten in a set order, typically with 15 steps. And as part of that Seder meal, there are all different food items which are proscribed and which have meaning that are imbued with them. And in part, we get this because we have so many traditions that we draw upon. There's the biblical tradition that prescribes some of the food items. There's the rabbinic tradition and sort of many layers of it that prescribe different foods and imbue them with different kinds of meaning. Because of this tradition, we have contemporary processes where we then even introduce new foods that don't necessarily come from the biblical tradition. They don't come from, say, the Mishnah or the Talmud. They actually come from today to reflect issues of today. Probably the most famous one of a sort of new introduction of a food is the introduction of the orange on the Seder plate, which is this idea that we place an orange, which is not a prescribed item at all from the tradition, on the Seder plate to represent those who don't have the same rights as everyone else. And usually the LGBTQ community is the one meant with the orange, or it could be women, depending on the story that you follow. But basically, and there's even more modern ones, like putting fair trade chocolate or fair trade coffee on your Seder plate to start up conversations about slavery and unfair labor practices during a time of commemorating slavery.
And this concept of bringing food and the quotidian aspects of life into faith and binding them together with symbolism, I just wonder if that's part of the reason why Judaism is so successful, whereas things like Christianity, certainly in my country, in the UK, you know, it's in decline, fewer people are going to church, and do you think that it could be because we don't wrap enough of everyday life into faith, whereas things like the Passover meal are bringing faith into the stuff that you put in your mouth, you know, the things that you're going to do every day, and it's binding things together? And I mean, is that the overall reason for doing this, do you think, Nora?
Well, we're commanded, actually, to tell the story, right? So for this particular meal, you have certain things that you're supposed to eat, and you're supposed to explain them. So that's actually wrapped up in the whole concept of the Seder, right? So, and you have not completed the Seder until you have explained these items. So we add on to this, right? It could be a very simple Seder. You could just have you and your family, and you could have those things out, and you could say, these are the things, and this is why we eat them, and it is because of this that God, you know, took us out of Egypt, right? You're commanded to enjoy the meal, experience the meal, as if you yourself were freed from slavery at this time. So as far as, I mean, I don't know if I want to get into why is Christianity not as...
Come on, let's do this thing.
I'm an Americanist, so I'm happy to talk about the dynamics, the dynamism of religion in the United States, where we don't have, you know, a state church. I think that sometimes has something to do with it, but that also doesn't explain Judaism elsewhere, right? Although I would say that there is a lot of creativity that has sprung out of American Judaism. Not that I'm, you know, like just looking inwards, but I think, you know, you have multiple movements that have expressed a lot of creativity around this meal.
Absolutely.
And historically.
Yeah. Okay. So, Helene, let's start just going through this part by part. So there are 15 steps to it, and there are a selection of foods. Can you just unfold the detail for us?
Sure. So there are 15 steps. There's the sort of the Kaddish. This is a blessing at the beginning, where that sort of opens the dinner. And it includes candle lighting, and it includes saying a blessing over the holiday. You then have orchats, which is where you ritually wash your hands. So before eating in Judaism, there's ritual hand washing. And so we'll see that within the ceremony. Then there's the ritual eating of a vegetable, often parsley. This part is called karpas, and it's dipped in salt water. And this is supposed to mix both the hopefulness of spring, represented by the vegetable, and the tears of slavery, represented by the salt water. There's then a ritual breaking of the sort of centerpiece food for the entire event, the matzah, which is unleavened bread, and that's yechatz. And then there is a prescribed storytelling portion, the magid, which is the story, telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And this has a couple of different parts. For most people, some of the highlights include, like, there's a part specifically where children get the storytelling started by asking four questions. In the case of my children, this is, you know, the period of great anxiety to have to ask these four questions, to get the adults answering the question.
And do they have to be asked in a specific way?
Yes. So there's four questions that are asked, and, you know, there's some pressure on the kids to deliver it in Hebrew and... Mm-hmm.
And they're usually sung, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're usually sung, and it is quite adorable. But I will say that the tradition is the youngest person present says it. So it's not always a child who is the person who is asking these four questions, but simply the youngest person who's in attendance.
Yeah.
Then there's another ritual hand washing. And then there is the blessing said over the eating of the unleavened bread. And then the next step, of course, is the consumption of eating the bread, which is preceded by a blessing. And that section, unsurprisingly, is called matzah, after the name of the unleavened bread. And then the next step is to eat bitter herbs, and that is called maror, and it's to remember the bitterness of slavery. And then there's one which is the eating of a sandwich made with matzah and bitter herbs. This is a biblical rule, and in many traditions, the sandwich is eaten as matzah, bitter herbs, but also a kind of sweet paste of some sort. Different traditions have different regional variations called charoset. In the Eastern European and German traditions, this would be chopped up apples, walnuts, and mixed together and held together with some wine or grape juice. And then there is the Shulchan Aruch, which is the eating of dinner. And Shulchan Aruch just means the set table. And that includes a dinner, usually multiple courses.
And is it likely to be lamb?
Some people do have lamb, but honestly, there's a whole wide range of traditions of what's served. There's often a soup course and a fish course, and there may be, you know, beef or lamb or chicken, or at least in a lot of American homes, a big turkey that is eaten. And lamb, of course, is traditional.
Just interject on lamb. There are some Jews who don't have lamb on purpose because of the tradition of the sacrificing of the Paschal lamb.
Yeah.
And so since there are no longer sacrifices since the destruction of the temple, there are those who, you know, want to make sure that they're saying, like, we don't do this anymore, right? I'm a vegan now, but when I ate meat, we would do lamb. Yeah. So, you know.
Now, in culinary terms, the culinary aspect of this is up until the main meal, it sounds not the finest experience to have, the finest taste experience to have. Bitter herbs, parsley dipped in salt. Is everyone desperate for that to be over, to get to the meal, or is it actually the unfolding of the story?
So, if I may, I think you're doing it wrong if you're waiting for the meal. And so there is this, you know, you want to avoid the when are we eating for real feeling, right? So, so you have all of these little appetizers, amuse-bouche, you know, yes, perhaps a little bit of horseradish here, a little bit, but you can, once you say the blessings over these foods, you can actually have lots of things. So we usually put out, we try to start the Seder not at the table, but in the living room, and kind of treat it as an extended dinner party. So, so you have time to really delve into the questions of the Seder, but you're also providing other foods, right? So you're doing the parsley dipped in salt water, but then you can also pass out potatoes, right? Or radishes, other crudite, other things you can dip, right?
Yeah.
You can do, if you're serving gefilte fish or a fish cake, we do like a hearts of palm crab cake faux thing. You know, you can pass those out at that time too. So I think it's important not to let your guests get hungry and have it be a natural unfolding conversation over apps and drinks. You've got wine, which is another very important part. My family likes to make shots, infuse a booze. You know, I start making the horseradish vodka early in the season. But yes, so it can be. I mean, last year I was thinking, we were laughing about this, you know, it was 4 hours before we got to dinner. we didn't totally realize it because we were eating the whole time, and then
then
you get to the meal. So
And how much variability is there in it? Which parts of it are absolutely obligatory and need to be followed in a specific way, and where are you allowed to indulge in a little bit of creativity, Helene?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of leeway in the tradition. I grew up in a family where we did a very lengthy version, which took 5 or 6 hours. But once I had very young children, we adopted a Haggadah that is the 30-minute Seder. And so we get through like that entire early portion that I mentioned before eating in 30 minutes. And then we're eating. And then you can, of course, the Seder is a break, and then the meal is part of the break, and then there's a whole other half on the other side that you can still talk and discuss.
There's more.
There's more. So, you know, if you have young children, you can do 30 minutes. You do the steps very quickly in rapid succession.
Yeah.
And then you just, you know, with just the blessings, just very short answers, and then you move to eating. And then the kids are happy with, you know, their dessert, and then you can continue conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, throughout history, tastes change and evolve, and you know, and what's around to be eaten changes as well. And I wonder how much has the Seder meal evolved over time? You mentioned oranges, but some of the other things like bitter herbs. Can it be any bitter herbs? And has this changed over time, Nora?
Yeah, and actually, if you look at some of the Seder plates that are made, you'll see that there's a place for maror and chazeret, which always used to confuse me when I was younger because I didn't understand why we had, you know, where does this lettuce come in, right? So, and the chazeret is usually, traditionally, I'm using the word traditionally loosely because we've just explained that there are lots of traditions, but frequently you'll see horseradish as the maror, as the bitter herb, either in its root form or in its, I don't know, adulterated, grated form.
Yeah.
And then the chazeret will have traditionally some lettuce. So, and lettuce used to be much more bitter than it is now, right? You can seek out bitter green, which I do at my farmer's market all the time because I love them. But really, when you buy lettuce like that is domesticated, it is sweeter. The chazeret refers to, and it takes the idea of having bitter herbs literally, like that there's more than one. Yeah. So yes, you can. So that's something that might change also. And then there are other things that people adapt. The shank bone, for example, even in the Talmud, you know, the rabbis allowed for vegetarians to use something else, sometimes a beet, because a beet bleeds and can also mark your doorway. You'll never get that out. And so those kinds of things can be changed. And it doesn't have to be parsley. You know, it can be any kind of spring.
Celery.
Yeah.
And so those things, and again, you know, regionally, depending on where you are, certain things grow at certain times.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, bitter herbs can also be like romaine lettuce. They can be scallions. In our family, we recently adopted using shrook, which is like Yemenite kind of paste that's kind of spicy and, frankly, kind of delicious.
You're enjoying it too much now. You're enjoying it too much.
Oh, no.
And so, tell me a little bit about, you mentioned wine, four cups of wine. Tell us a bit about that. What's the significance of that?
The reason given for the four cups represents the four expressions used in the Bible to describe God taking the Jews out of slavery. This is from Exodus. I will bring you out, I will deliver, I will redeem, and I will take. There are all sorts of other rabbinical interpretations about why there's four, the number four, but also wine is ever present in Jewish traditional meals and Jewish celebrations. I mean, wine is part of the set ceremony every week during the Sabbath meal. It's part of the ending of the Sabbath meal every week. It's part of holidays like Purim, where one is commanded to actually drink so much that you can't tell the difference between two men's names. And so drinking as celebration is an integral part of Jewish religious tradition.
Mm. Now, odd question to ask here, but in the Catholic Church, there's the concept of transubstantiation, of eating the body and the flesh of Christ. Now, that sort of sense of being removed from the stuff itself and eating the symbol, should it be as strong? Is there a sense of calm and a moment of being lifted from the present and being taken away into something that's symbolic? Or are you basically eating and chatting?
I mean, I think that we call matzah the bread of affliction because there is this idea that you are supposed to imagine yourself as someone who has been redeemed from slavery, but not in the sense of, you know, the actual transformation.
Yeah.
It does not go to that kind of extent. The ceremony does ask you to put yourself in the place of those who were redeemed or were freed from slavery, but not, there's no theological, literal transformation of you into that moment.
Right. There's not the same kind of, I mean, we talk about miracles a lot, but we don't share the idea of the miracle of transubstantiation. It is symbolic. It's purely symbolic.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, now, I just wonder, Nora, what's your favorite part of the meal? And why would it be your favorite?
Well, Passover is my favorite holiday, so I love all of it. And
why? Why is that? What is it, bringing a family together? Is it a faith
thing? No, I mean, I think that, well, first of all, in the United States anyway, it is the most celebrated holiday for Jews. More Jews take part in a Passover Seder than almost anything else. And there's just so much room for creativity and discussion and bringing it to the current day to discuss issues of injustice. I think it's a holiday that everyone can find something in, regardless of whether or not you actually believe that there was a God that split the Red Sea, right? We can all sort of dig into these ideas of freedom and oppression and use it as a way of kind of communicating our contemporary concerns.
Yeah. In the same way that Chris, you don't need to be Christian to enjoy Christmas, I guess.
You can celebrate anyone's birthday and have good food and gifts and family time. But I love the Seder. I love the book that with the Haggadah, which we use. We've been putting together our own for years and years, and I update it every year. It's a nice form of procrastination during the early part of the spring semester for me. Oh, well, yeah, I've been working on that. But right now I'm gonna update the Haggadah. And my husband and I have kind of took over the Seder from my family when like years and years and years ago. And he loves to cook. We both love to cook. So it was, you know, he's not Jewish. He loved the idea of the game of trying to make a delicious meal within certain parameters. You know, where you there are certain foods you absolutely cannot use. And now, you know, we're vegan, so it's like the ultimate like challenge, right? It is like you can't have eggs. Eggs are in everything. Eggs are so important. So it's
especially at Easter.
Yeah, but it's such a challenge. Yeah. So anyway, but I enjoy planning the meal. I enjoy everything that leads up to it.
Helene, what's your favorite part?
I think I have to echo what Nora said and say that I also enjoy the whole process of, you know, there's a ritual to cleaning your kitchen. I mean, this is spring cleaning and creating this kind of space and buying foods that you grew up with. In many ways, I think it's similar to a lot of Christians love, like, you know, the whole preparation for Christmas where you're buying all these foods that evoke all of these amazing memories for you. But I think one of my favorite parts, if I had to pick a part of the actual Seder meal, is the afikomen. So at the end of the meal, there is this ritual of hiding that half of matzah that was broken earlier and letting the children kind of find it. And, you know, there's a kind of sneaky quality to where to hide it and the kids trying to find it and then their excitement over finding it. I sort of enjoy that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. OK, now we've talked a bit about faith, about family, about kids and everything. This is a food industry podcast. I'm wondering if Passover meal has been commercialized in the same way that Christmas has been commercialized. Are there, it has it become a sort of a brand-led affair? Are there things that you have to buy or you're drawn into buying specifically because of the food industry?
Yes, is the answer. No, Passover food is big business. So for people who keep kosher for Passover very closely, as Helene said, you know, there's this whole ritual of cleaning your house, cleaning your kitchen, getting rid of anything that has what's known as chametz, which is the prohibited foods, but it's a bunch of grains, primarily wheat, but other things as well. And so you can't have a hint of any of it. And so if you go to a supermarket where there is a large Jewish population, you will find a huge kosher for Passover section where there's things that are specific for the Passover holiday, right? Mm. So obviously kosher for Passover matzah, which in places where there are not large Jewish communities, you'll often see matzah that is not kosher for Passover put out for Passover. And we can talk about why some matzah is kosher and when some matzah isn't. You'll see matzah meal, which allows you to make the matzah balls. You'll see a lot of horseradish. You'll see a lot of items that are specific for the Seder, along with, like, you know, various accoutrements. But you'll also see things that are just normal everyday foods that have been made kosher for Passover.
Yeah.
And have been observed to be sure that, you know, there's no cross-contamination and it's been watched by kosher authorities. So it is pretty big business. I mean, the big thing that everybody loves is that around Passover, so this is a different thing, but there's a thing called kitniot, which Sephardic Jews have had and Ashkenazic Jews traditionally didn't eat. It's a category that includes legumes, corn, and rice. So Coca-Cola, which usually has corn syrup in it, unless you get like the really good Mexican Coke. During Passover, you can buy...
That phrase can be interpreted various different ways. So let's be very clear. It's about Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola, yes. Mexican Coca-Cola is made with sugar. And so during Passover, there's all of this Coke with yellow caps, which signifies that it's been made with sugar and is therefore kosher for Passover.
That's really interesting because Coca-Cola has a you know, their Christmas ads are famous, and you kind of think, why Coca-Cola at Christmas? I don't get it, but I guess it's lots of companies just you know, getting on the gravy train and throwing life at it.
Probably one of the biggest companies to do commercialization or to basically build a business around Passover food is Manischewitz.
Yes.
So in the 1880s, they open the first matzah factory. So before that, you would buy your matzah like kind of handmade in round circles that were, you know, packaged in like newspaper or something like that. But at the same time that Americans became really interested in things like hygiene, et cetera, you have this mass-produced matzah that comes in a square. So matzah didn't come in a square before, but now we have these square matzahs that are produced in a factory, which Manischewitz, you know, advertises, we don't have anyone's hands touch it, right? So it's super clean.
Yeah.
And not only do they have matzah, which is sort of mass-produced, but also there's a whole line of other foods that, as Nora mentioned, are not required for the eating of the Passover meal. Cake mixes that are kosher for Passover, or more importantly, macaroons, these kind of little coconut desserts. And this year we're having a big thing because this year, instead of the traditional cans, Manischewitz is selling them in bags. And we have sort of a social media explosion about like, oh my God, they changed the packaging. So not only are there these foods that have become part of what people's traditions are, these were created by these food industry manufacturers.
Yeah, and the square matzo was controversial when it first came out too.
They thought
this will never take off. People will never accept this, right? And this is what we think of when we think of matzah now.
Which is extraordinary. And how is that viewed? Is that viewed as a sort of negative industrialization of something that ought to be homespun and about faith and about family? Or is it just an inevitable spread of making life easier for people?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah, I personally am very grateful to have, because I have lived in areas with which have high Jewish populations where there's all of these items in abundance and you can go to the store. And yes, they're very expensive because they're produced for this one time a year. But I can load up my cart and I can make all sorts of things very quickly and cheaply.
Yeah.
And when I have lived in areas where there isn't much of a Jewish community and I don't have access to any of these things, I am personally producing all of this stuff myself, and it's exhausting.
But part of the journey, I guess, at the same time. Do you think that the food industry in the West pays enough attention to Passover? I mean, obviously, there are hurdles, certification and things like that are very important. But is it easy enough for people to get hold of the foods that they need to celebrate? And could more be done?
I mean, you know, going back to what Helene said, also, you know, if you live in a place where there's a large Jewish population, it's very, very easy. Mm. But we also have this thing called the internet now, which allows people to order things too. So I think that, I mean, it's big business. I think Passover is pretty well, there's attention paid to it, I think. And as someone who is not strictly observant, there's plenty for me. But for my kosher keeping family, I think that they seem to be okay. Is there anything, Helene, you wish existed that doesn't?
I know that I said that what I love is the whole tradition of making all of the items, but I mean, I also spent a Passover in Israel, and it was a whole other world of, you know, you could get everything catered, pre-made meals. I mean, every bakery transformed so that there was everything you could imagine in terms of baked goods, et cetera. That was very eye-opening. So I wish that there was more options like that. But, given the current situation, I'm not wanting for anything. I'm spending this year in Budapest on a research fellowship, and you know, there's one kosher market in the city, and I went and I bought my items for Passover, and I was able to find not all the things that I like, right? No macaroons, which was sad as an American Jew. But I was able to find, you know, many of the things that I would expect to find to be able to make Passover.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some kind of interesting trends that have occurred of, well, not trends, but sort of the, you know, there's so much emphasis now on sustainability and kind of trends of fermentation and making your own stuff. In the last decade, there have been several cookbooks that have, you know, tried to get you to make your own matzah, which is not something that you can do for, you know, the 8 days, right? Like, but it is sometimes fun, especially if you have kids, to try to make your own matzah, because part of it is that it can only, you use wheat to make matzah, which is one of the forbidden things. So if, to make it, you have to make sure that it doesn't have enough time to rise. So then you have a timer going, you know, 18 minutes, you know, you got to make sure it gets from one place to the other and the other thing.
Yeah.
And it can be kind of delicious. Mark Bittman did a thing in the New York Times, I think, on making your own matzah. You know, the idea is that it could be really delicious. You put some sea salt on that bad boy and, you know, all kinds of different ways to make your own bread.
Or my favorite, you put some homemade caramel and chocolate on that and you make matzah crack, which is like,
It's all kicking off now. It's all good. You've gone bad. Gone to the other side. Okay, I've got a, now this question is slightly off topic, but we do a huge amount of episodes about plant-based meats and plant-based fish and things like that. And one question that I have never asked is, what are the kosher rules relating to plant-based proteins? Are there anything, is there anything that we should know?
Yes.
And have there been any sort of certifications that you can tell us about?
Well, as far as certifications, I'm not sure. This is something that is definitely coming up a lot. And I can say that my husband is actually a vegan butcher here, not just in New York.
He knows all about it then. Yes, you're the person with the job.
He makes all the plant-based meats locally. Yeah. And we are closed the week of Passover because so much of it would be impossible. So seitan, which is a major form of, you know, that people use for plant-based meats, you know, is wheat gluten, essentially. Mm. So that is off the table. Kitniyot, which is that category I mentioned earlier, would include soybeans. And so tofu's out the window. If you eat tofu during Passover, which I do, that's not a problem. But for those who hold by that tradition, you can't have that. So it is complicated, but I would say that it depends on what tradition you hold by. I think that this is a relatively new thing that kosher authorities, whatever you hold by, are working on and trying to figure out. Because it's been controversial, even not during Passover, what is allowable.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating. Okay, so my last question to both of you is: well, I'm going to come over to your Passover meals. What would surprise me, do you think, about how things unfold, or about what's said, or the atmosphere within which it all takes place? Helen, what is there anything that you think would make me kind of go, I just didn't realize that.
I mean, if you were coming to my brother's Passover Seder, I mean, they do their own Passover Haggadah, and they create themes for their Passover Seder. So in the past, they've had Harry Potter Seder, and maybe that would surprise you.
That really would surprise me.
You might have to adopt a house for your Passover sort of experience. Wow. In the past, I've hosted it, and you know, I'm a Holocaust historian, and so I usually incorporate elements of Holocaust history into my own traditional Seder. So, you know, I might share with you, for example, about matzah making in the Jewish ghettos during the Holocaust, or some other element that would be part of my Seder that would be unique. But I guess if I had to sort of summarize it, it would be that people personalize their seders. And it's that personalization that I think might look different to you coming to a seder meal. Another tradition we do is the Miriam cup, which is not part of the traditional seder, but has been adopted to remind people of the presence of women during the Exodus. And so there are a couple of traditions that my family has adopted that would look different from if you went to somebody else's.
Gotcha. Yeah. And Nora, what do you think I'd be surprised at your Passover feast?
Well, I mentioned some of it already, I think. I mean, I too make my own Haggadah, and we start out in the living room. We're not sitting around a table for 4 hours before the meal. And unfortunately, it is 4 hours sometimes. Fortunately or not fortunately, my kids are getting older. They insist on having all of the things involved. Even during COVID, when it was just four of us, we thought, okay, well, I guess it'll go faster. It didn't. They were like, what about this? What about this? And, you know, the kids do a lot of parody songs during the Seder. Mm. And it's very booze heavy. I mean, we have these like shots, maror yeah. shots.
Yeah. The shots is quite an intriguing one. Yeah.
We also do
horseradish vodka.
The horseradish vodka is very good. We also do a parsley gin, which you take with a little lick of salt and some.
And that makes it all right.
I think it's the ability to personalize it and be inclusive of the community that you have, you know, and recognize who you are, who you're with, who your allies are, who your, you know, your people are.
Well, I think what's surprised me most from talking to both of you is the creativity involved in it and the fact that, you know, it's about what you want to do as much as what you need to do. So I think it's absolutely fascinating. Well, I'll take up the invitation and I'll see you very soon. So Nora Rubel and Helene Sinrick, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Now, did you know Food Matters Live is launching a digital publication in April with exclusive content all about careers in the food and drink industry? It'll shine a light on the fascinating career options available with inspiring talks, podcasts, and of course, job listings. You can sign up to receive it, or if you're a company, register to become a partner by searching Food Matters Live Digital Publications. Thank you so much for listening.